Hello, this is Issa Can with The Long View. It's our pleasure to have Solitaire Townsend on the line today from Boston, where she'll be a guest speaker at MIT this afternoon. Solitaire's work is also invested in the support of sustainable development. Her communications organization, based in England, is Futera, and we'll soon be discussing the unique perspectives and knowledge that inform their services. Before we get started, please note that The Long View has a new web address. It's now thelongview.net. Please email thelongview@wuml.org as opposed to the website thelongview.net. Welcome, Solitaire.
Hello, welcome.
It's very kind of you to give us some time this morning ahead of your super busy day in Boston.
No problem at all. It's actually afternoon for me because I only flew in yesterday.
That's right, yeah. Well, in reading your bio, it's impossible to overlook that your first master's degree is in Shakespeare.
Yes.
Many of our guests, though, have made similar professional leaps in their lives before they arrived at their interest in sustainability, actually. So was there a particular moment in your life that urged you away from the words of the bard and towards communicating sustainability?
It was actually, I was acting as a theatre director in London, and I was putting on a Christmas pantomime. And I'd always been very heavily involved in social development and in direct action mainly, so getting out there on the streets. And I saw an advert in the newspaper for someone with an arts background to study for Masters in Sustainable Development, which, by the way, I didn't know what that was at the time. But the concept of being able to bring together my arts and communication background with sustainable development was too good an opportunity to miss. So I packed up my job and I applied, and I managed to spend a year doing a Masters in Sustainable Development as the only person with a non-science background on the course.
Interesting. That's very interesting. That is quite a combination, but I could see how that could work very well. According to your literature, Futera advises some of the biggest corporations in the UK. What motivates them predominantly to be interested in sustainable development or corporate social responsibility?
In many ways, it all depends on who you speak to in the company. Lots of people who we work directly with are personally motivated to make a change. You don't necessarily have to go and work for an NGO or a charity to want to make a difference in the world. However, the further up in the organization you get, the less permissible it is, even if you have those kind of views, to express them. And so it becomes more and more about the business case. And in the UK, and indeed in Europe, the business case is very strong. Consumers are demanding this. Government is demanding this. And so it's very easy to pull together a business case about why you should take action on climate change, sustainable development, etc. But I do sometimes feel that I'm writing business cases for things which people want to do anyway. That although it's not permissible to speak about it at the highest level, with the amount of communication, especially on climate change, that you're getting in the UK at the moment, it would be a very hard of hearing senior manager who was unable to spot which way the flow was going.
Right, right. That's interesting. I would say that the American public isn't pressing quite as hard as it sounds as though they are in England, and I wish that were the case here as well. You know, do you have a couple of examples of corporations, and you don't have to name names in any case unless you want to, that appear to have exceptionally healthy environmental policies in the UK?
It's quite strange, because some of the ones who I'd wish to name, such as BP, Shell, etc., probably have some of the worst reputations for it. And there's a reason why they now have, Shell especially, has some robust policies in place, not that they always manage to stand up to them, is because they've had so much criticism over the past. Those organisations such as British Telecom, BT, which is the large national telephone system in the UK, has an excellent environmental policy, but it's been evolved in darkness. No one's there looking in. And so although it's excellent in many parts, it's not in others. A lot of the smaller players, some of the mid-cap companies, have got excellent work as well, usually driven by the personal decision-making at a very senior level. But chances are, if you find a company that's been under an enormous amount of external pressure for a couple of years, they're probably going to have done more to put their house in order than those that haven't.
Right, right. Yeah, I understand that some of the companies are sort of preemptively enacting sustainable development type policy, realizing that that is the wave of the future. Have you been disappointed with an organization that did not implement the sustainable concepts you recommended?
Many times over, and not always just from corporations. I've been disappointed with government departments that we've worked with, and I've also been disappointed occasionally with NGOs that we've worked with. This is a very difficult type of business change, business model to bring in, or organizational model, and to maintain over time. One of the main initiators of something going wrong is when a passionate, committed individual in the organization leaves or moves on. In fact, it is slightly scary how much we're still dependent upon passionate, motivated individuals inside organizations making a change. I wouldn't obviously want to mention any names, but there has been circumstances where when a industry or a company goes into some financially difficult times, they look for things to cut, and this may be one of the areas which sort of is up for the chop when you're looking to cut costs. That is an extremely foolish thing to do. It's one of the, for socially responsible investors, it's one of the indicators of a company that's got financial problems is when it starts cutting this sort of stuff. But it does happen, and it will continue to happen. It's happening an awful lot less than it was when I started my career.
That's very interesting.
So in the past 10 years, that has changed.
Do you find yourself, as part of your services, looking for those actors inside of corporations or government that have a passion for the environment or sustainable development?
Actually, I don't usually have to look for them. They usually find us. Mm-hmm. What I spend my time looking for is the ones that don't.
Right.
We run lots of training courses for people on communicating sustainable development, for senior managers on how to articulate sustainable development. It's not always the easiest thing to get across to your investors or your employees.
Mm-hmm.
I always get very enthusiastic when I get access to somebody who isn't bought in, who isn't motivated, because I don't want to speak to the converted. That's not what our job is. There's enough people doing that already. And so often what I attempt to do is the passionate converted seek us out, and then we go and seek those who aren't.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know if there's been a time when an organization only used the media strategies you provide to distract the public while it continued its environmentally destructive activities. I mean, my example would be, you know, a given oil company who is highlighting its research in alternative energy, renewable energy like wind turbines, but they're simultaneously burying the effects of a massive oil spill in a natural refuge. I mean, I think that you've probably seen that for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been the case with any of your own clients, actually?
It's an ongoing concern. We're a communications organization. We're a communications organization of a whole load of passionate individuals who are doing this because they believe in it. So the danger of greenwash, of being used to greenwash a company or a government department or another organization, can be incredibly difficult. We don't have the money resources and are often not allowed to undertake an extensive audit on any of our clients.
Mm-hmm.
So often it's a situation of trust. And it has happened. It's happened twice, and in both cases we put the client down. But in both cases, the individuals, relatively senior individuals that we were dealing with inside that company, felt as betrayed as we did.
Yes.
In that this idea that a company of 150, 200,000 individuals, that everybody knows everything that's going on, is of course completely impossible. And so often the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, and it can be far more emotionally difficult for the individuals that are stuck in the organization when something like that happens.
Right.
However, in terms of the work that we do, if we think it is going to promote sustainable development, if we think it has value in getting people to be aware of what of the sustainable development movement, we will work with a number of clients who historically I've been arrested for campaigning against.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a quite interesting position to be in, is two years ago to have been handcuffed for sit-ins outside companies, and now to be invited into the board level to be discussing with them how they're going to promote sustainable development. I sometimes wonder if they know.
Yeah, that is kind of disquieting for you sometimes, I wonder. I mean, I've probably been in similar positions, and I have some similar interests. Let me ask you, what have you learned about the people with whom you've worked over the past few years at the corporate level? You know, what, to that end, do you have a very different perspective of corporate members as opposed to when you were out there performing activist activities?
Absolutely. I had, I think I'd sort of forgotten in all of my ire at what companies were doing, I'd forgotten that actually there isn't some computer sitting at the middle making decisions, that this is all fallible human beings, and that in a company of 150,000 people or more, you get some fantastic human beings, you get some really quite dangerous human beings, and you also get the majority of people who are just people getting on with their jobs and their lives and taking the money home to the kids. What has really made me aware of is that the business education, that most business education, most MBAs actually fail to prepare their students for the world in which we're living in now. The average MBA syllabus does not cover the 21st century world. It covers very much the 1950s, 1960s world in the way of business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite interesting the number of MBA students, of very standard MBAs, who actually request to come and do an internship with Tutera because they themselves have identified the fact that they're not getting the type of rounded education required to work in a globalized world within natural limits. With the ongoing science of climate change, etc., that they have to keep up with. And so most of the people that I meet in within business are decent, reasonable human beings, completely unprepared and unqualified and uneducated mm-hmm. to deal with some of the issues that they're dealing with.
Right, right. Well, what are the most important things about communicating sustainability? Do the corporations learn from you personally, Solitaire?
Both corporations, government and NGOs.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, if I'm speaking to a head of marketing, I'll use a different set of hints and tips if I was speaking to an average business user. But there's some very simple things to do. The first is to be extremely careful with the language. We are working in an environment, we're working in sustainable development, that has a certain love of jargon. And the jargon can be extremely alienating for senior decision makers. Nobody likes being made to feel stupid, and sometimes the language of sustainable development can do just that.
Mm-hmm.
It's because of its academic underpinnings and that academic robustness. It's fantastic, but it does make it very difficult to engage with. So the first thing that we do is really challenge people's language, including the words sustainable development themselves, which my grandmother finds it quite difficult to pronounce when she doesn't have her teeth in.
Right.
It's never a good indication of a good communications strap line. Then once we've interrogated the language and tried to find different ways of saying things, especially if we're encouraging a corporate to communicate to the public, we try and remind them that they're very good at this anyway. And so not to think of sustainable development as an entirely different thing that they need to communicate. They are excellent communicators. They have enormous communications budget. They have fantastic marketers.
Lucky them.
Exactly, lucky them, unlike the rest of us. And that they need to use that experience and that expertise rather than what they often do is because they're so scared of their ability to communicate this appropriately. Dull down. Take any type of passion or emotion or excitement out of what they're doing
mm-hmm.
in order to be taken seriously. And we say that's a foolish thing to do. Use the resources that you have in order to communicate this
right.
With the same sort of passion as you would your product.
Right, right. Interesting.
So language, passion, and then we also encourage people to try not to think about words all the time, to think about visual and images as well. An enormous amount of people who are working this come from a heavily academic background and become very linguistically obsessed.
Right.
An enormous number of people out there in the world actually respond far more positively to images and pictures and visuals than they do to long reports and enormous number of words.
Yes.
And so we encourage people to say, if what you're trying to say can be said in visually, dump the language, say mm-hmm. it visually.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, there's that old adage, a picture's worth 1,000 words at least, right?
At least.
Absolutely.
In sustainable development, probably a few more.
Yeah, thank you about that. Those are interesting insights. I'd like to talk a little bit about the consumer, the mm-hmm. target audience of media's messages. How do you get to know the consumer? How do you research the marketplace in order to determine the messages and the venues for those messages?
Well, the first thing is not to assume that you know. It is one of the death knells for communications, is to be talking about a target audience and to make any type of assumptions about them. It always must be based on rigorous and robust market research. Getting money for market research is sometimes the most difficult thing in sustainable development communications. And so often we try and piggyback on market research that companies or government are doing anyway. Mm-hmm. There is beginning to be a development, a body of research out there on how the public responds to these issues, which actually in some ways are slightly different to the way in which they respond to other things, and that has been invaluable to us. So we'll do quantitative standing on street corners, asking people questions. So, for example, a recent government review showed that 95% of people in the UK agree that climate change is happening and that something needs to be done about it. So those kind of statistics are quite compelling. And then we'll sit down for long hours in focus groups across the country and, in fact, increasingly internationally, with people to discuss how they respond to this, how it relates to their values, how it relates to what else they believe in, and also most critically, who they're going to trust to talk to them about it. Because on this issue, almost more than any other out there, the levels of trust are very low.
Right. Yes, actually, to that end, I'm a bit skeptical that consumers are sufficiently aware of the nature of capitalism, you know, in Western society, the nature of economics. What can the public do to become more media savvy so they aren't duped by the less ethical corporations that venture to distract them or mislead the public, you know, with these sort of faux campaigns, environmental campaigns and such?
Well, historically, that was always quite difficult because we had so few channels of communication. Advertising through the television and radio is one of the main sources of information on what corporates were doing. Increasingly, that's changing. And online and in the internet, in blogs, in wikis, etc., there is a wealth of information that you can log on to. In fact, for some companies, if you put their company name into Google, for example, the third entry will be from Corporate Watch or Transparency International, giving a very objective overview of that company's environmental and ethical criteria. Mm-hmm. However, we must also trust ourselves. Recent research has shown that although some of us are, well, most of us are quite difficult at judging technical information because we're not experts in that information, we are very good as human beings at spotting lies and hypocrisy and untruths.
Solitary.
Really?
I wish I could believe that myself, but we have a country at war based on a lot of misleading information, so...
I think what's quite interesting about that is the fact that it's not always been the information. What people are responding to is the emotion. Is that on information, we can be quite good at spotting mistruths. The question is whether we're trying to. If somebody has already made an emotional decision that they agree, then they're not going to be out there looking for lies and mistruths. We have exactly the same situation in the UK. And when you do it, dig down into what people actually know about the situation, you find that actually they know very little, and nor do they care.
Right.
They had already made an emotional decision that they support the action, and the justifications actually, although they matter to a number of us that look at those sort of things, actually they don't matter an enormous amount to a wider group of people.
Right.
On things such as corporates, we have a slightly different situation, and of course I'm speaking very much from a UK context, but that there already is a general mistrust of corporate information, a general prove to me rather than I'm already open to being proved to.
Right.
Again, depending on whether people have already made an emotional decision. And there's a real disconnect at the moment, especially amongst the young in the UK, between a growing mistrust of corporations and a growing desire for the products and services that they provide.
Right.
It's a really strange catch-22.
Well, Solitaire, thank you for the services and positive information that that you provide today on this segment, and the services you provide into corporations. We're building on sustainable development from every angle, and your angle in communications is so important. I need to wind this up. I could have spent another half hour with you easily. Thank you again for your time. It's much appreciated.
No problem, and I'm going to be listening to The Long View on the internet, hopefully, from now on from London.
Oh, that's very sweet. That's very generous. Okay.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
Goodbye.